Thanks for listening to the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Doug Gottlieb Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio.
What up, America? Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. Today, coming to you from Atlanta, Georgia, on my way to Clemson, South Carolina. Man, I'm fired up. It was a tough call, and I think I may have made the wrong call. I don't know. My son's 9 years old. A couple years ago, we watched the Clemson-Louisville game. You probably remember when Lamar Jackson took Louisville in there. And second half, he played really well. They came back, nearly won the game, and Deshaun Watson ended up putting their thumb on him and winning late. My son at the time, he fell in love with Howard's Rock and the entrance. I thought ESPN did a great job kind of telling the story of it. And I do some work for a company called Stadium. If you know about Stadium Sports, you can watch it online on Twitter and Twitch and I believe on Facebook. I've done basketball games for him. Tomorrow we'll be doing a college football show. Eric Wood, former offensive lineman, Louisville, Buffalo Bills, you remember him. And C.J. Spiller, of course, former NFL running back, also a former Bill, and former Clemson Tiger. We'll be doing just kind of completely live, 1 hour, talking about college football from Clemson, South Carolina. And then I'll walk over to the game and watch him rub Howard's Rock, and they're taking on an undefeated NC State club. That'll be a ton of fun. So I chose not to bring my son. And it was a tough call because you would have missed 2 days of school or 1 day of school, whatever. Not that big a deal when you're 9 years old, right? You had a sub yesterday. I didn't even know they got like a party today. Who knows? But I do think there'll be another opportunity. But I remember my dad told me a couple of things that still resonate with me today. Like going to Clemson, I remember him telling me there's actually paw prints on the highway leading to the stadium. I thought that was cool. Another thing my dad taught me was he was a basketball coach since the day he finished college, getting his master's degree at Columbia University. Went to Ohio State, got a degree, and then went to Columbia University and got a master's degree. And he had to get a master's to be a high school coach at the time. He was a high school coach, became a college coach. Got fired in 1984 at Long Beach State, kind of bounced around professional basketball and minor league level. And he started his own business with my mom. My mom's an interior designer. And I remember him telling me that, he said, listen, once you work for yourself, you'll never want to work for anybody else. That resonated with me. Right? I was thinking about the Clemson Tigers. I was thinking, once you work for yourself, you never want to work for anybody else. So I watched LeBron James last night. And I understand that he's technically working for Jeannie Buss and for Magic Johnson. And for Rob Pelinka, and frankly for Luke Walton, but the ownership that he has taken in the rebuilding of the Lakers franchise, and there's a bunch that has been discussed: is LeBron too Hollywood? Are there too many things? Look, it's a heavy load. It's a heavy burden, and we can tackle that. We can discuss that. But if you watched the game, if you listened to the game, if you observed the leadership that he has shown, and if you know, like I do, the kind of inside details about how he's trying to shape the thing to the image that he thinks is the best and most sustainable, you understand that he's taking ownership. He's working for himself. Like, look, LeBron James says he's worked for Pat Riley. He's worked for the Cleveland Cavaliers. And he's never really taken ownership over other decisions. Has he encouraged the organization based upon things he said and things that he's done and the way that he's acted? Yes. But ownership, that's different. Take a listen to this clip last night early in the game.
We got you. Anytime you fall, hey, anytime y'all fall, stay down. Your brother come pick you up.
I want this to be a brotherhood, a family. A different sort of organization. And this is what we're going to do. LeBron is very smart. He is incredibly strategic, and he has his own production company. He's already worked for himself. He will never want to work for anybody else. And so I understand this thought that it's a wasted year. No, it's not. The hard truth about the Lakers and what they're doing is that they know they couldn't win a championship this year. LeBron frankly knew he couldn't win a championship if he stayed in Cleveland. So the idea that it was a bad decision because either they lost a game or they ultimately won't win a championship, that's only telling the hard truth to fans, which is, hey, guess what? Even if you have LeBron James, every year you can't win a championship. Even at 34, every year you couldn't win a championship. Because the Celtics are better and because the Warriors are better. And frankly, the Rockets and the Thunder, because of their experience together as well as their talent, they're probably better. So whatever else was left for him, be it Philadelphia, staying in Cleveland, or coming out to the Lakers, or playing in Timbuktu, this is actually the best possible option. And additionally, and more importantly, the way to completely engage LeBron in the process, to not lose him to Hollywood, to not lose him to his family, is to give him a chunk of ownership. If you listen, I have an all-basketball podcast. It's called All Ball. 2 weeks ago, we had Aron Ganot. He's the head coach at Hawaii. When he took over Hawaii's program, they ran workouts at 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning Hawaiian time. And after a month, the coaches stopped showing up, and they let the players have ownership of it. I had Randy Bennett on, who this past week, we just dropped it yesterday. Randy's the head coach at St. Mary's, where Aron came from, and this is one of his philosophies, which is let the players have ownership of their program. That's what LeBron's doing. It doesn't mean that LeBron's coaching. It doesn't mean that LeBron is making every business decision or making every free agency pickup. But he is sculpting and remaking this team in the image that he most wants it to be. He's creating in his likeness. He's starting his own business. He's working for himself. Because as my dad told me, 35 years ago, 30 years ago, once you work for yourself, you're never going to want to work for anybody else. And LeBron James has gotten a taste of that in what he does in the private sector, and that's what he's trying to do working in the NBA. He doesn't own the Lakers. He doesn't run the Lakers. He doesn't coach the Lakers. But he doesn't work in reality for the Lakers. He works for LeBron James, Inc. And if you watch how he's playing and watch how the team's evolving, I think you get a sense that's he's trying to create in an image that he feels is he wants to be most representative of his career. And look, they weren't great last night. Weren't great at all. Couldn't make a shot. Which one of the things I told you, you cannot prepare yourself for the LeBron James thing, right? Like the game is in Portland. And you're like, oh, wait, yeah, Portland's a zoo. Not only because Nike's headquartered there, but so is Adidas, and they have Damian Lillard. So even one of the smaller NBA outposts like Portland was a buzz last night. That's going to be every Lakers road game for at least the first half of the season and most of the second half of the season as well. So look, some of it is confirmation bias. You didn't think Rondo can shoot? He can't shoot. You thought this roster was made up of guys that hadn't shown the ability to consistently make threes and they don't make them. But I think part of it is the pressure and speed and pace of playing with LeBron James against a team that's playing at a higher level of intensity defensively because they're playing against LeBron James-led Lakers. It's like all of those Lakers who are coming back for year two, it's hard to calculate how good a shooting team they'll be. Josh Hart, for example, came off the bench and hit some shots. He's a far better shooter this year. Ingram should be better because they're still in the growth phase of their... On the other hand, they've played in the NBA technically, but they haven't played in the real NBA. Right? Like, Ingram hadn't played in the real NBA. Hart hadn't played in the real NBA. Lonzo hadn't played in the real NBA. So you look around that team. Kyle Kuzma, who got exposed, they tried to play him at small ball five, hadn't played in the real NBA. Now you're playing the real NBA. It's almost a different sport. Wait till you get to the playoffs when it's cranked up even more. So, yeah, catch your breath. They'll adjust. It's like hopping into the – if you ever been to your son at the batting cage, right, and you go and you try and hop in the 70 machine, and that thing is humming by you, like, holy cow. But then you go in a couple times and you adjust to the speed and you can probably hit it. That's the deal with the young Lakers.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Now the Red Sox are in the World Series. They await the winner of tonight's game. The guy who will be on the call of tonight's game is the great John Smoltz. He joins us on Fox Sports Radio. Smoltz, let's start two nights ago. Let's go back to Kershaw. That adjustment that – why do you think, by the way, his velocity is so down from Pete Kershaw?
Well, I mean, some of it has to do with a little bit of what he's been dealing with. And injury-wise, I'm sure, you know, lower back a couple times, 2 years in a row. It takes its toll. And what you don't want to do as a pitcher, you don't want to force velocity. And so you sometimes feel what you have is what you have, and you learn how to pitch with it. That's one thing he's always been able to do. But the biggest adjustment he made in his second game was he had a much better slider. That slider is everything for Clayton Kershaw. It was not good in his first game, and he made the adjustment, got out of a big inning that ultimately could have got away from him, and then never looked back. So his combination of fastball, curveball, slider is as good as it gets. It's not the late life type pitch that we got used to see with the velocity, but I don't think that really matters. If he's healthy and can repeat his mechanics, I think he could put the ball where he wants to.
John Smoltz joining us here on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. We'll get to tonight's game, which, of course, pregame coverage starts at 7:30 Eastern time, and the game gets underway on Fox at 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. That's Game 6, Brewers welcoming in those Dodgers. David Price, the peak David Price in the playoffs is when he first came out of the Vandy, and he was with Tampa, and he came out of the pen. And, you know, the deal in Boston has not worked out well. But he picked up the ball last night. What did he change? What allowed him to be so successful in what he had struggled with before?
You know, it's a great question because he got hot the night before. He was up in the bullpen. He had fired his bullets. You know, although be it trying to get ready for a short situation, you rarely do that and then start the next game. I've seen a lot of things this postseason that are uncharacteristically not conducive for people to have success. But managers have chosen to do things in a different way. And the upside downside, you got to live with it. But what he did in that game was he finally got to the point where when he commands his fastball, which he does a lot, but the combination of his fastball and changeup. See, he doesn't throw his curveball anymore, and he really doesn't have any other change of speeds other than that fadeaway changeup, and that he makes the right-handed hitters conscious in, and then they got to try to get their bat started, and then next thing you know, he throws a changeup. I thought his combination of command and changeups were as good as it's going to be. And, you know, that was huge for him psychologically. I'm sure physically he was kind of spent.
Yeah.
But mentally, he, you know, he got over a pretty big hurdle, and I'm sure he was tired of talking about what he hadn't done, and now that one game, it doesn't erase every other game, but it sure puts it in the back pages and allows him to move forward and his team in the World Series.
It's fascinating to listen to you talk about pitching. I want to ask you about hitting, though. Because it did feel like the Astros, who you had the controversial call in the first inning, and then you have the unbelievable catch by Benintendi, which ends it in the ninth inning. How much of the psychology of we probably should have won the night before, in their own minds, we should have won the night before, feeds into, because I used to watch other teams when they would face you, not necessarily you, but maybe your setup guys, or especially Mariano Rivera, right? And you get to the fifth inning, and you know that Mo was coming in, And you get to the sixth inning and you start to, well, he can get it. And guys would swing uncharacteristically out of their zones because they felt like they couldn't hit Rivera. Was it last night those guys, you know, trying too hard to make up for losing the night before?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly times where you press a little bit, but I would say when you feel like you've got the best pitching in baseball and the combination of their pitching and bullpen, and not to mention the offense that they possess, this was going up against another great offense, and that other offense just beat you. And they beat great pitching. You look at the numbers off of the starting pitching and what they were able to do. Boston just basically put so much pressure on Houston's offense that maybe they just couldn't match it. You know, teeter-totter game in the game you talked about with the home run that wasn't a home run. They took the lead. Boston took the lead. So once you take the lead, you're not even thinking of those two runs that weren't part of your, you know, scoreboard. So this is just a matter of a team that when you think about winning a postseason series, I lost track. 19, 20 runs with two outs. That's almost impossible, and that's a backbreaker, and that's what Boston did. They got two out hits after two out hits, and those hurt, man. Those sting, and they did them off a great pitcher. So you really, really have to credit them for putting so much pressure on the offense of the Astros that they're not used to that from their pitchers. Their pitchers usually shut everybody else down. So this was just a better approach by the Boston offense.
Smoltz, we've discussed this before because I know how much you care for the game, and you know I love baseball. My son plays baseball. I'm concerned with the future of baseball from this aspect. This is the time of year when the mainstream fan buys in, right? Locally, the numbers are sky high. People are still going into ballparks, but nationally, this is the time. And that Dodger game the other night was. Or was it? Well, no, it was the Red Sox game two nights ago. They were 5 hours long, and then you know the Dodger games, especially with the Brewers making so many pitching changes. I don't know whether you're going to hold the audience. I understand that the computers tell you and analytics tell you to find the right matchups, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how salaries are adjusted and whether or not people are paying big money for some of these players when they're easily replaceable for a more favorable matchup. That's interesting for the offseason, but for the long-term sustainability of baseball, what do you do with the length of these games due to all the changes that are being made, pitching changes and pinch hits?
Well, you've hit all the high notes of basically clips that people are talking about. And from the standpoint of strategy doesn't care how long it takes or who's watching. Strategy is put forth with a bunch of data and a bunch of equations that basically give you a blueprint for they call it a pathway of success. And when you go through certain moments, like you've mentioned, it comes sometimes and might be coming at a cost to some who say, I just can't hang in there, especially games on the West Coast. So at the end of the day, I don't have a lot of answers for it. I know those concerns, and those will be addressed in the years to come. Baseball usually has kind of a reciprocal kind of approach where it corrects itself. I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon. But I will say this, you know, this year's Milwaukee Brewer team will not be next year's Milwaukee Brewer team. They will not do this next year. This is out of necessity. I've said this could give, you know, some hope to other teams, and it might be a false read for a blueprint of success because you can't do this in a regular season. So when you get to the postseason and you have your matchups like they have them, this is their only formula for success. I've always said since I've played the game and when I've been out of the game that usually about 90%, I think, when the team usually has the most innings pitched out of their starters, that team usually goes on to win. And this could be an exception if the Brewers can prove they can win these next two games, because the Dodger pitchers, starting pitchers, have been really good. And, you know, time will tell. When you've just got to look at the last 10 to 12 champions, the World Series champions, not any one of those teams fit this kind of new age model as far as blueprint for success. But in time, if this ends up disrupting the flow of how we look at baseball, then other teams, I'm sure, are going to look at ways to try to increase their chances. But you've hit all the high notes. That's not something that, you know, no one has noticed. It's just part of where we are today in baseball.
John Smoltz joining us. What about the Brewers' offense? Only 16 runs, hitting .219 with a .653 OPS against the Dodgers. What's gone wrong against that Dodger pitching?
Well, you know, fair or not, the reason that Yelich is going to win the MVP, he single-handedly carried the team in the second half. I mean, that kind of production in the second half is unbelievable. They are a top-heavy offense, meaning their front five guys do a lot of their damage. Although, this postseason, it's been the bottom 7, 8, 9 that has really got them the wins they've gotten so far. So,
Woodruff hitting home runs and getting walks, that changes things a little bit.
I'm telling you, it's been amazing. And if they get any production out of the top five, they're going to benefit now from flipping the script of their offense that had so much power and production out of the top. So you got to credit, again, the Dodgers starters. They've done a nice job at being able to keep Yelich at bay. And look, I said this, you always have these different sayings. Would you sign up for a 3-2 deficit in the beginning of the year, two games at home for the Milwaukee Brewers? That's what I would be selling our team. And the answer would be unequivocally yes. They've had an amazing stretch, an amazing run. It's going to be super loud. And if they get a couple guys to wake up, they're going to have a bullpen ready to go to shut this thing down and force a game seven.
John, thanks so much for your time. I know you're super, super busy. Love listening to you call the games on Fox, and best of luck tonight.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific.
The Dallas Cowboys defense is ranked fourth in yards per game, second in points per game. And they get back Sean Lee, who, of course, is their leader. They're Sergeant Holka, if you remember the movie Stripes. Their big toe in the middle of that defense. The two parts to what the Cowboys are doing, which is, I don't know if I want to say genius, or they're just kind of figuring it out. They had 23 first downs. That's great. That's great. 23 first downs. On third down, they were 7 of 17. That's big. And they possessed the ball for 38 and a half minutes. That's dominant. But the reason they were able to do that was their defense. Holding the Jaguars to 4 of 11 on third down. They ran 72 plays as opposed to the Jaguars running 47 plays. Think about that for a second. And in the NFL, a relatively low number of possessions. Right? They had 11. The Jaguars had 12. Their game plan of running the football, playing 11-on-11 football, freeing up Dak to be more of a runner, and stopping the run and limiting people on third down. I know you're sitting there going like, well, no, Doug Gottlieb. It was helped in large part by the ineptitude of Blake Bortles and the lack of running game without Leonard Fournette. But if you look at the defensive rankings for what the Cowboys have done, the Cowboys' strength is their defense, and they figure that thing out. That's it. And they're shortening the game. You know, go take a look at what happened with the Chiefs. How'd the Patriots beat the Chiefs? They possessed the football. 36 minutes. They won by 3. The Patriots only won by 3 points. But how are they able to move the ball late to get into field goal range? Well, a good portion of it is they had the football. In other words, the Chiefs were on defense for 13 minutes longer than they were on offense. So instead of sometimes concentrating on Dak Prescott, who I do think has done a good job, the Cowboys allowing 17 points per game, second in the NFL, 315 yards a game, fourth in the NFL, and they're eighth and seventh in terms of pass and rush yards. Plus, again, after the pass, they're pretty good, even though they haven't had their full allotment of pass rushers the first 4 or 5 games. We pay attention so often to quarterback, 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 quarterback. Kind of set on who Dak is, and I do think making him a runner will put one more, activates one more guy into the box, which frees up more of their receivers, which is what they need because they don't have a ton of talent. But it also kind of deceives us from exactly what's going on. And Cole Beasley was really their only consistent threat. 9 catches, 101 yards. Why? Well, because you take one guy out of the defense if you allow your quarterback to be a real runner. And Dak ran it 11 times?
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
He'll be calling Michigan State. He's the one, he's the only, Joel Klatt. He joins us here on Fox Sports Radio. I want to get to Michigan in a second. You and I have been pro-Michigan when everybody else jumped ship. Now people are trying to get back on the bandwagon as they figured out how to use Shea Patterson. But let's talk Michigan State first. I saw them against Utah State, a game they very well could have lost. They did lose to Arizona State, who has gone 1-4 since that game. And though they just beat Penn State on the road, huge win that comes off of losing to Northwestern at home. Who is Michigan? Give me a sense of Michigan State because they've been all over the map.
Yeah. I mean, good point. Studying for this game has been interesting, breaking down the film, watching them from game to game. The first thing that you do have to understand about Michigan State, Doug, is that they have been a MASH unit. You know, I mean, the injuries and the coaches, and credit them because their coaching staff, led by Mark D'Antonio, does not create excuses for themselves like other coaching staffs would. And you've been around those type of coaching staffs, you know, in broadcasting that will tell you every injury under the sun, and they use it as a crutch. Michigan State is not that way. And yet they've had just probably more injuries than maybe anybody else in the country. Last week they traveled to Penn State, and they had 6 of their normal starters that didn't even make the trip on offense alone. They had another corner that was missing, so they had 7 starters not playing in that ball game. They were able to go out there and get a win. Last week was the first time all year that they had the same 5 offensive linemen start a game and finish a game together. That same 5 is back. So I think some of the inconsistencies can be explained away just based on that. Having said that, I think the worrisome part about Michigan State is that they don't run the ball like they used to, and this is a team that relies heavily on running the football. And they're going to need to against Michigan because Michigan is once again leading the country in pass defense. This would be the 3rd straight year if they were able to hold that number one ranking that they would finish with the number one pass defense in the country. And Brian Lewerke the last 2 weeks really has thrown the ball 50 plus times for Michigan State. I don't think that's a game plan that's going to be successful for them, and they don't either. So they know that they've got to find some semblance of a run game if they're going to, you know, keep this one close and ultimately pull the upset.
You and I have both watched Michigan and said, man, you know, they lost the Tariq Black kid who was supposed to be their top wide receiver, and there's a paucity of game-breaking talent out wide. They seem to have made up for that using Shea Patterson in a way in which he's more comfortable out of the pocket, both running and throwing out of the pocket. Does that make their offense explosive enough to run through the Big Ten?
I think it does. You know, it was eye-opening for me, and people have gotten on me this week because when I'm talking about Michigan, I tend to always compare them to Ohio State because I think those are the two favorites, in particular with Penn State losing twice already in this season in the Big Ten Conference. And after coming away from the Ohio State game and seeing Michigan both on tape and then live against Northwestern, I come away thinking to myself, boy, this Michigan team's got a great chance to win the conference. And the reason is not necessarily just Shea Patterson, but what he gives them and then where they've improved from where they were in previous seasons. You know, last season alone, they were putrid protecting the passer. They did not convert on 3rd down very well. And because of that, they couldn't sustain drives and they didn't score many points. This year, that's totally opposite. They're one of the better teams in the country converting on 3rd down, in large part due to the run game on 1st down, which I know that's kind of a chain reaction. But part of that is that Jay has the ability to run, and some of those quarterback-designed runs created all sorts of mismatches for them last week against Wisconsin. He rolled out that 81-yard run, and it wasn't until he did that then Caron Higdon started getting loose and ended up getting over the century mark because Higdon in the first half did not do much. He was 7 carries for 11 yards, basically, in the first half, and then Shea got loose, and it opened everything up. a quarterback that can hurt you with his feet is the great equalizer in college football, Doug, and now Michigan has that. In fact, Shea has converted more third down conversions with his feet this year than all of Harbaugh's quarterbacks combined the first 3 years he was there.
Wow.
That's an element of this offense that has been lacking, missing. Now they have it, and I think it makes them one of the more dangerous teams maybe in the country, but certainly in the Big Ten.
What do you make of Wisconsin? Why the disappointing season? And I know they thumped Nebraska, but Nebraska stinks. And I know they beat Iowa at Iowa, which is always a good win. But, I mean, I don't know. They just you keep throwing a quarterback out there who he was awful. I can't believe they let Hornibrook play in the fourth quarter. Didn't mean he wouldn't start this week against Illinois, but he was shook. He was shook by that defense, and he was so rattled he couldn't complete anything. Is Hornibrook alone the reason that this team is not as good as they were supposed to be?
No. I think that he's getting an undue share of the blame, actually. Because and I broke down his games leading into that Iowa game that we called. And Doug, he had been very good for them, dating all the way back. He was even pretty good against BYU. He was decent against Ohio State last year in the Big Ten championship game. Dating all the way back to their game against Michigan, he had played some really good football. So this was more of the aberration. Early in his career, he struggled, and he would have those huge stinkers of a game. And this was one of those, and I think that's an alarming thing. More so, I think, for them is that defensively they've been so good for so long, and they're struggling finding two things. One, consistency in the back end, and the second thing, Doug, they rely heavily on their edge rushers and their edge defenders in that odd front. They have the stand-up outside linebackers. They've had guys like T.J. Watt and so on and so forth,
right.
Vince Beagle. And they don't have that guy anymore this year. They've had some injuries at that position. They don't have great edge setters, and it's really tough to run this defense if you don't have great edge setters and you don't have consistency in the back end. They should get Dakota Dixon back, their safety, this week. The last week in the first half, due to targeting an injury, they had both of their starting safeties that were not on the field against Michigan. So I think some consistency issues as far as roster goes, and then the fact that they don't have those edge rushers is what's really contributing to this. But I hear you, but I think that Alex is, one, their best option, and two, I think he gets a little bit of the undue share of some of that blame.
Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. That's Fox Sports lead college football analyst Joel Klatt. Let's keep in the Big Ten. And you've come out in support of Nick Bosa's decision to leave Ohio State and get ready for the NFL draft. Now I do think that somehow we're kind of conflating other stories, guys skipping bowl games with this one. Guys skipping bowl games because they don't want to get hurt is different than a guy who actually has been hurt and might not be healthy until the peak time in their season. What's your take on the Bosa decision?
Yeah, first of all, that's an important distinction that you made there. Very important distinction. A few different points I'd like to make. First and foremost, I don't think this is an epidemic. I think that these are very isolated incidents that suck up all the air out of the room. And, Doug, we talk about them a lot, whether it's the bowl game scenario or even a scenario like this, which is more unique. So that's one thing. The reason it's not an epidemic is because there's not many guys like Nick Bosa that have completely solidified their draft stock. So many guys are still trying to improve that draft stock. This dude's got the $30 million ticket. He's a top three pick all day long, probably was a year ago. So, again, very unique set of circumstances. The other thing I'd point to is what you talked about, but also more so, it's such a unique injury. You know, I think that this injury has been called, you know, abdomen. The thing about it is it's kind of more of a sports hernia. And
yep.
This surgery that a lot of guys go to the Philadelphia area to get, whether it's pro or college guys, it takes a good 2.5-3 months to heal up from that, just to then go out and test to see where you're at. See, this is not a fractured bone. This is not a sprained ankle where the requisite rest and you're going to be 100%. An abdomen injury is just so much different because you can't test it. You don't know until all of a sudden you try to make an explosive movement and then, whoa, all of a sudden you're set back 2 or 3 weeks. He didn't want that, obviously, heading into the most valuable time in his life. So I think that's been conflated a little bit. And then also this fact, if you had, and I made this analogy, and I don't know if, it, you know, maybe it's good, maybe it's not, but if you had at home,
Don't undersell your analogy, Klatt. Don't understand your selling. I'll tell you if it's not good. Don't worry.
Yeah,
just go
you
like.
You can grade it. I tell you what.
Okay.
You grade it. The texters and Twitter can grade it. Here we go. So if you had your whole life worked to restore a beautiful old car, and it was your pride and joy, and you spent hours and hours and months and years tending to this car, you were like Cameron's father and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and you rubbed it with a diaper. You know, it was everything.
I got it.
And you knew that all of a sudden in 4 months, someone was going to give you the equivalent of $30 million over 4 years. And all you had to do was get the car to April. And all it had to do was be functional and in the condition that you got it to your whole life. Would you drive it around?
Probably not. It's a good analogy. It's a really good analogy. It depends what I got the car for. That's honest.
That's what I got the car for.
Because there is a certain.
Why wouldn't this be everybody, Doug? And I'm saying, well, not everybody has that car. Not everyone has the car where someone guarantees you, yes, I'm going to give you $30 million over 4 years. Again, that's where this is so unique. Everybody else is still working on their car. So you got to go out and you got to test it. You got to race it against other ones, all these different things. Everyone else is still trying to establish the value of that car. If someone told you your value is established, why would you drive it?
Because you get to drive the car. here's why. Because, for example...
Well, you're going to get to drive it after April.
No, you'll drive a different car. You'll have the money in your pocket to go buy another car. You'll never get to play. Here's what he's turning down. Okay? And I understand the thing. And just because his brother's... People will say, well, his brother made money. He doesn't need money. No, that's his brother's money. That's not his money. Okay? There's very few, if any, career-ending injuries anymore. Let's just kind of be honest, right?
Jalen
like medical
Smith
science.
Would tell you that even if you don't end your career, you can cost yourself $25
million. It's fair. It's a fair point. I mean, you're talking about
Marcus
one
Lattimore
in a million.
Would disagree with you.
Huh? Well, that was his second time he tore his ACL in a year. Second time.
Well, let's not throw those out like those. It happens. That's what I'm trying to say. It happens.
I mean, it's happened once, right? He's won.
Yeah, but Bosa's not perfectly healthy. Again,
Willis McGahee's leg broke in half in his last college football game. He had a long NFL career, so he can work the other way. My point is, very few, if any, career enders anymore. It could cost him money, but here's what you put on the line.
If you got the injury to begin with, why would you go out there and potentially get it hurt worse and affect your value?
I understand. And I also think that those games that he'd be coming back and playing in, it's not like coming back and playing against Illinois. It's coming back playing against Michigan. It's coming back playing in the Big Ten championship game. It's coming back playing in the national semifinals and the finals. Like, that's a higher level, and it puts more stress and strain. On the other hand, if you re-injure your hernia, you just have a hernia surgery, you'll be fine. He'll still be a top five draft pick. But that's not the point. My point is, like, there's still the human element of it. And I can only tell you that I want football players that want to play football. And you got a guy who could play for... Now, I guess here's the issue.
The human element of value? I don't mean to interrupt if you average the...
That's a business element.
...football programs, they take in about $31 million.
No. You're doing the thing to where you're taking an argument and changing it into a completely different argument about what you want to be about, which is about paying players.
Remember, these kids are put into a different scenario where they are... There's only two skills, Doug, that you in America as a young man cannot monetize for some arbitrary reason. Now, I'm talking about skills, not degrees. The ability to play basketball, the ability to play football. Artificially, you are held from monetizing those two skills artificially. Okay, so I don't want to blame a kid if he takes his own future into his own hands and says, listen, I don't want to play a few exhibition games late if I've already established my value and someone's going to hand me $30 million over 4 years. To me, that totally makes sense. And quite frankly, I don't think he owes Ohio State anything. If I was Ohio State, I would say thank you so much because we just essentially got you for zero. We didn't have to pay you a dime, and we got you. You got to increase our value. We got to ride your back for a while.
Hold on. Joel, Nick Bosa did not increase Ohio State's value one iota. There's not one
you're
less
kidding.
Ticket.
So you're
there's not
me
one.
You get a
there's
one
not one. Hold on.
There,
hold on. Hold on. It's not true.
Kids. Oh, this is absolutely true. You get a bunch of one-star kids, and they're a zero-win football team. They've got the same value. You think that wins don't matter?
Have they lost?
You think Duke going out there and losing every game is going to establish the same value?
Hold on a second. Again, you're changing the argument. He is not playing. He's not going to play for Ohio State ever again, correct?
Correct.
Is there one less person that's going to watch Ohio State play?
No, but
is there one less person that's going to go to a game? Is there one less person who's going to go to a game?
That's been built. All I'm saying is that if you take him and others like him away, Ohio State's not what it is.
But listen, we can go round and round. My point is this.
You're basically,
you only get one more.
You're taking the most skilled framer from the construction yard, and you're saying, like, at the end of the job, once he's framed the entire house, now
you're also making this a college football argument. You're making it a college football argument. The NFL says, we don't want you for 3 years. We don't want you for three years.
These kids don't have a seat at that table. You have to understand, that's a CBA-negotiated thing which they're not able to negotiate at that table. Veterans in the NFL, why would they want young kids around?
Okay, but again, you're making this about what was college football.
Collusion, and it's illegal, and we go along with it.
It's not collusion. It's not collusion, and it's not illegal. It is not collusion. It's not illegal. It is collectively bargained based upon for the union and the owners.
You're wrong. I'm not wrong
because if it was collusion,
are artificially holding people that aren't party to those negotiations out of the negotiations. That's collusion.
No, if it was collusion, somebody would have gone to court and sued and won by now. And it hasn't been because this is the system that's been set up. And listen, my point is simply this. You get one more, like, dude, you want to tell me that I would be okay is if we got to the middle of November and he's like, it's not going to happen. I'm not going to be able to do it. I want to play against Michigan. But pulling the ripcord now tells me that it's a business decision, which is fine. But don't tell me that you love football, that you want to play football, that you love your time. You're a captain at Ohio State.
You got a chance to finish undefeated. Why don't
undefeated.
You throw the middle card out there every time a coach leaves for a higher salary?
When a coach leaves for a higher salary, he's leaving a contract. When a player's leaving, we're okay with him leaving a contract to sign to play for a year for Ohio State?
The scholarship is a contract.
It is a contract, and he violated the contract. And he violated the contract. Wait, if you have a deal, if ESPN comes in and says, hey, we're going to give you $10 million, and you're going to place Herbie next year, but in order to do so, you got to walk. Okay, you got to walk from Fox. You can't do any games the rest of the year. How's that going to go over?
Where's the
Fox
door?
Fox is going to shut you down so you can't ever be on broadcast TV for the next 5 or 6 years because that's what the contract says. That's the power that they have. But the media, we take the stance like, oh, good for Nick Bosa. He violated a contract, but it's cool.
We can pay ourselves. Don't worry. All the millions of dollars, we'll pay all the coaches and administrators and the commissioners are going to pay themselves millions of dollars. But heaven forbid, Nick Bosa actually takes his own future into his own hands after establishing his own value.
You establish your value based upon what you do in college, and then after college, you go out and you become a professional. That's what happens in hundreds of professions across the country. Joel Clyde joining us. I totally disagree.
Again, name another skill that you cannot monetize until some arbitrary time. Set up.
Being a doctor, being a lawyer.
That's a totally different thing. A doctor is a degree.
You just said name a profession. I named two.
No. I didn't say profession. I did not say
in
profession.
Order to be a teacher, you have to have a teaching degree and a teaching certificate.
That's a degree. I said skill.
That's how they judge your skill. Yes, it is.
How else
can they tell whether or not you have the skills to be a teacher? Is it arbitrary?
False.
Sure. Huh?
That is totally false. A degree is not a skill. It's a requisite amount of knowledge. A skill set is a skill set, period. If you're a cellist or a violinist or whatever, you can go monetize it at any time. As soon as your skill set is that it's good enough to earn a living with it, you can do that except for basketball and football because we want those administrators to get their claws in you until they can squeeze all that value out. Get into a contract.
Why is it necessary you make administrators who have earned their doctorates, who support their schools, make a couple $100,000 into the worst human beings on earth? I mean,
Jack Swarbrick making $3 million is a couple $100,000. Really? The AD at Northwestern making $1.5 million. That's just a couple $100,000.
But $1.5 million for a guy who's been working for 20 years in the business is not actually that much money compared to what he can make in the private sector.
Okay, then go to the private sector.
Joel Clad joining us in the Doug Gottlieb Show. Last thing, NC State taking on Clemson. I'm going to get the chance to go to this game. I've never gone. I do want to ask you. the kid at NC State is supposed to be a first-round draft pick as a quarterback, right?
He's underperforming so far. That's the word I'm getting. I haven't had a chance to study him, Doug, and I will after the year. But from the conversations I've had with a few scouts and even a couple of GMs, they're saying that he has under-delivered so far. And it's not just production or wins and losses. Remember, it's a very different evaluation. Meanwhile, the kid up at Oregon, he's the one that's over-delivering. People are saying that his stock is going through the roof. But if you're asking about that game in particular, I just don't buy that NC State is good enough. Remember, Clemson's coming off of a bye. Mm-hmm. The last time they played, they won 63-3, and their quarterback is a young kid that is going to get better and better every time he goes out, because that's what happens with young kids that are getting more and more reps. So Trevor Lawrence is a guy that I fully expect to continue to get better. And that defensive front four for Clemson is so good. They're one of the nation's leaders in sacks, tackles for loss. I don't see a way in which the Pack is able to compete with Clemson.
I will point out that they won in overtime 2 years ago, same field, and they won by seven last year at NC State. NC State traditionally has played them very, very close, especially with this.
They have. I think the one thing that I'm concerned with is that generally when Clemson has struggled in the past, the Syracuse games notwithstanding, it's been because of dominant defensive lines. And all those guys now are in the NFL. We've seen, you know, what Bradley Chubb has been able to do with the Denver Broncos. But you're right that historically NC State has played well. I don't see it this year, but I might be wrong.
Joel, great stuff. Good duel. Enjoy safe travels to East Lansing, and look forward to hearing
your
call.
Give me name and likeness. I mean, the universities don't have to pay. Just give them their name and likeness back.
It's not actually valuable. It's not actually valuable. I hate to break it to you. Johnny Manziel's been gone from Texas A&M for years. They haven't sold one less seat, one less jersey, haven't been on TV any less. Just it's kind of a it's actually colleges.
Which, by the way, Manziel, at the height of his name and likeness value, was prevented from getting it. So now,
no, he wasn't. He got the Heisman. He got the Heisman, which he can profit on for the rest of his life. Okay. Values in that brand. Joel Klatt, the values in Joel Klatt's brand. He happens to work for Fox. They gain all the benefits of having Joel on their air. I'm kidding. Joel, great stuff, dude. We'll talk to you later.
Have a good one, brother.